a movement of concern about nuclear arms and nuclear war is spreading throughout the country. A group which calls itself Ground Zero has seen to it that maps were published in almost all of the local newspapers, which superimposed upon the local typography a series of concentric circles stretching out 12 miles from the center of the city, illustrating the areas of maximum destruction which would occur if a single nuclear bomb was detonated at the center of the city's population. Another group which calls itself Physicians for Social Responsibility has been arguing on any number of platforms and a large number of seminars that to discuss only a single bomb in a single place is to misunderstand the threat that we face and to undervalue it. In point of fact, if a single bomb drops, it is likely that a whole strike, nuclear strike, will occur as part of a nuclear war. And that if this occurs, the dangers and destruction multiplies geometrically. We must think not only about a 12-mile circle of destruction of buildings and of the murder of a civilian population, but we must think also about the destruction of life itself by the aftershock, the firestorms, by the pulsating of the shocks which will destroy so much of life, by the destruction of the infrastructure of all the institutions of the society, by the destruction of the fields, the harvests, all that support life on Earth, by the destruction of the ozone layer which protects this Earth from various kinds of destructive rays which bombard us from outer space. Now, all of these concerns have become part of the of a great public debate which we see recorded daily in the newspapers and projected at us daily, weekly on the radio and the television, triggered, I suspect, by the belligerency in act and in deed, sometimes more in words than in deed, but this perceived sense of belligerency which exists in the two great nuclear capitals of the world, Moscow and Washington. President Reagan has talked rather carelessly about the possibility of winning something he calls a limited nuclear war. Mr. Khrushchev has governed a country which in the last years has undertaken a major escalation of the arms race, and Brezhnev's government has seen to it that a whole new group of middle-range land-based missiles, the SS-20s, have been emplaced west of the Urals, pointing at Europe, in effect blanketing Europe with the possibility of instantaneous destruction. Unfortunately, given the all-too-simple truth that any nuclear war is folly, that no one can really win a nuclear exchange. Unfortunately, given that fact, both governments, both of the major superpowers, have shown themselves recently incredibly deaf, dumb, and blind to the needs of the world to devise ways to reduce the danger of Holocaust, to give us some hope that we will not only destroy ourselves, but destroy all of the history which presumably could happen after us. The Soviet Union has said, oh yes, we're in favor of some kind of reduction in nuclear weaponry. We're in favor of a nuclear freeze of middle-range missiles. And of course, what is implicit but not stated is that the Soviet Union, because of its recent activity, has been able to emplace its missiles throughout its Eastern Europe and its own Western country. While we have not yet put in place our Pershing II cruise missile, the countervailing weapon to the SS-20s. And we, for our part, have said, no, we're not prepared for a nuclear freeze, but we are prepared for some kind of withdrawal of reduction in nuclear arms if the Soviet Union first withdraws these SS-20s, which of course would mean that we would gain something before we entered any kind of nuclear negotiations. Each country, in other words, seeks to gain something, gain a military advantage by before it enters into such negotiations, and in point of fact has delayed whatever negotiations were undertaken. President Reagan, before he achieved office, because of the manifest popularity of his position, played a great role in the defeat in the Senate of the SALT-TRU Treaty. And since he has been in office, he has called back our negotiators at the SALT Treaty, claiming that he is not in favor of strategic arms limitation talks, but he is in favor of strategic arms reduction talks, where presumably we would be able to reduce the level of armaments in the world, not simply limit them. It's a semantic argument, because in point of fact, there have been no talks at all. All that has really been achieved has been the fact that for 2 years, the Soviet Union, and now increasingly the United States, has plunged ahead recklessly but with determination to increase the already existent nuclear overkill which exists in our several arsenals. And so it is that throughout the country today, in this week which has been proposed as a ground zero anti-nuclear weaponry week, people in churches throughout the country have been praying, Lord, help us to become instruments of peace. And they have, I'm sure, been reading that great prophecy and poem that exists in the book of Isaiah, which perhaps most exemplifies and most captures man's immemorial hope that we will not destroy ourselves. It shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains. It shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall come and say, come ye and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk out in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between the nations and shall decide for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, lo yilmedu od milchama, and they shall not know war anymore. Now, Isaiah here captures a prayer, a hope, a vision, which we all share. But the point I should like to make with you this morning is that when all of our anger and frustration at the current administration is taken into consideration, when of all of our continuing anger and frustration at the intransigence of the Soviet Union and its continuing military buildup is taken into consideration, a kind of innocent and romantic and passionate outburst against nuclear weapons will achieve very little. We need to find practical and effective ways to reduce nuclear arms. But unilateral disarmament, plans for some kind of scrapping of all the weapons of war which exist in the world, of creating some kind of world government immediately which would eliminate all sovereignty, all these are utopian and messianic. Which is to say, they are impractical, impossible. I wonder in how many of the churches where this second chapter of Isaiah is read out, and where everyone shares as we have shared in its hope, the minister will bother to remind his congregation that this is not a poem, but a prophecy. It's a prophecy of what will happen ba'acharit hayamim. And it shall come to pass ba'acharit hayamim, in the end of days. And the end of days, acharit hayamim, is a technical term in biblical Hebrew, which describes what a period of time which occurs after time, after history, after the world ceases to be as we know it and have experienced it. It was the belief of the ancient Hebrews that God would at some point in time intervene, bring the world as we know it to an end, bring the human being as we know ourselves to an end, and create a new world, a world in which peace would reign because a new kind of human being would have come into existence who would be free of all of the contradictions of human nature from which we all suffer or are blessed, depending upon our own self-judgment. Ba'acharit HaYamim describes a time when the Torah is written large in everyone's soul, when there is a new spirit and a new soul within us, when we can no longer sin, when we are no longer given to acts of cruelty, self-destruction, violence, all of the kinds of uncertain acts to which we know we are as human beings prone. Ba'acharit HaYamim, peace will be universal, because man will not have within him the temptation, the frustration, the anger, the greed, the viciousness which leads ultimately to war. But until then, that is, in the real world as we know it, Judaism insists, yes, you must seek peace and pursue it. That's a clear mandate, one repeated again and again in our tradition. But it also, in our tradition, has taught us that when a man comes to kill you, you must do all that is in your power to defend yourself, even if it means that you must take his life. In the real world, we must remember that people act out of a complex of motives. And utopian, innocent, messianic visions are often suicidal because they lead us to give over control over our lives to those who have no illusions about power and the uses of power and the advantages of the use of power. In early February, a man named Jonathan Schell published in the New Yorker magazine a series of three long articles, which were subsequently published under the title The Fate of the Earth. Mr. Schell's book, Articles Become a Book, has become the manifesto of the anti-nuclear movement. They are beautifully written. And in the first chapter, he brings together in a scientific way, if you will, all of our concerns and all of our fears and gives them shape. He calls that first chapter The Republic of Insects and Grasses. And he describes there the scientific evidence of what will happen to this country or any country if it is subject to a major nuclear strike. And what he says essentially is that the bulk of the scientific evidence is simple, that this will not only be the end of days, but the end of life itself. That we not only will suffer the 20 or 30 or 50 million dead that the various RAND studies or other think tank studies have suggested, but that these studies do not describe the entire horror of what we face, because the whole ecological system on which life depends will be destroyed. Disease and famine, all the feared horsemen of the apocalypse will become the reality. He closed by writing this: in trying to describe possible consequences of a nuclear holocaust, I have mentioned the limitless complexity of its effect on human society and on the ecosphere, a complexity that sometimes seems to be as great as that of life itself. But if these effects should lead to human extinction, then all the complexity will give way to the utmost simplicity, the simplicity of nothingness. We, the human race, shall cease to be. That is, that after a nuclear strike, the world will become a republic of insects and grasses. Only the simplest forms of life have any hope of surviving a nuclear holocaust. Now, Mr. Shell's picture is effective, stark, and staggering. And there are scientists who claim that he has exaggerated somewhat the picture. It really makes very little difference. The degree of a holocaust is something that none of us would want to try to endure in order to be able to describe. But when we turn to the conclusions which follow from this tragic picture, we find that Mr. Shell says, in effect, the strategic arms limitation talks, strategic arms reduction talks, attempts at unilateral movements towards disarmament, a country taking one symbolic step in the hope that other countries will follow suit. All the proposals which have been put forward by all of the statesmen and thinkers of the world are what he calls aspirins given to a patient after the patient suffers from fatal cancer. The only hope we have of survival, the only hope, is to destroy the concept of the nation state, to destroy all concepts of sovereignty, to remove all national boundaries, and to bring into being immediately a world government which would have take away from all peoples and all groups and all sections of the society all of their weapons, conventional and otherwise. And what will be the motivating force for this great achievement? Fear. Somehow fear will propel us to take this action which we have not been able to take in all the preceding generations of history. I wish it were so. But as a rabbi, as someone who has lived all his life with trying to understand people and their emotions and human psychology, I know that fear is more often a destructive than a constructive emotion. That fear more often leads us to irrational and sometimes suicidal actions rather than those which are constructive and beneficial. And when Shell himself confronts the question of how this scenario is to come about, he's reduced to saying, quote, how all this will come about, I leave to others to tell us. And that's no answer at all. There are those who tell us that mutual assured deterrence, the concept under which we have presumably established peace these last 35 years, is madness. As a matter of fact, the acronym for mutual assured deterrence is MAD. They say to us, what kind of sanity is civilization evidencing when peace depends upon warheads at ready in silos which have the ability to destroy cities and millions of people? When some of the countries of the world have sufficient missiles in their submarines and on their planes and in silos in the ground to destroy not only an enemy, but all other countries and themselves many times over. The whole concept of deterrence has been brought into debate. Now, when you enter the mad world of armaments, when you become Alice in Wonderland, then you've got to leave behind the kind of sensibility and sensitivity and good sense with which we normally operate in the limited context of our daily lives. Because you enter a world in which, in fact, deterrence does make sense. You enter a world where deterrence makes sense because we are the kinds of complex people that we are. It's sobering to recognize that the only country ever to drop live atomic warheads on another country, the United States, use these weapons against a country which had no means of atomic retaliation, Japan. And a more telling example, perhaps, is the use of germ and biological warfare. Apparently, the Soviet has been able to use what they call yellow rain for some years now. But the yellow rain was never used against the United States in Southeast Asia, because we have the power to retaliate. But when we pulled our troops out of Southeast Asia, suddenly the yellow rain began to appear used against Hmong tribesmen and other mountains people who did not have a deterrent force. It's simply not true that if you are exposed in the sense of powerless, you are therefore more likely to survive against an enemy. Because the enemy is an enemy. And in the cruel reality, which is the world, the jungle of international policy, governments are capable of doing what probably none of the individuals who compose that government would on themselves do: perform acts of utmost cruelty, holocaustal acts, if you will. Deterrence, I'm afraid, is the reality of our times. And even those who have become most passionate of late of what's called the nuclear freeze, which is a movement which has taken its key from the bill which Senators Kennedy and Hatfield have submitted in the Congress, a bill to freeze the development and deployment of all nuclear weapons at the present level, a bill designed to say simply, genug, it's enough. We have submarines under the sea, we have planes in the air, we have missiles in the silo capable of destroying the Soviet Union. How many more missiles, how many more planes, how many submarines do we, or do the Soviet, or does Great Britain, or France, or India require? And as an expression of genug, the nuclear freeze movement makes good sense. It's a way of our saying publicly to our politicians and statesmen, we're going to hold your hand to the fire until you meet with and find ways of negotiating with the other members of the nuclear club to reduce the dangers of nuclear war. But on a practical level, the administration has responded to the Kennedy-Hatfield bill and to the nuclear freeze movement people by saying, a nuclear freeze will simply freeze in place a Soviet advantage. They have those SS-20 missiles in place. Our Cruise-2 missiles are not yet in place. We'll negotiate when we're at a parity. And the answer to that, of course, is that once we get the cruise missiles in place, the Soviet Union will simply take another step in the development procedure, and there'll never be that ultimate moment when finally the Brezhnevs and the Reagans, these belligerent folk, will get together for negotiation. So it's an expression of anger and of political determination and political will on the part of at least this citizenry, the nuclear freeze movement makes some sense. But I'm afraid that many are reading far too much into it. Let's assume that there is a nuclear freeze. Let's assume that the Soviet Union and the Reagan administration agree to hold in place the development and deployment of all nuclear weapons. What has changed? Will any one of us be any less free of the fact that we are targeted by some missile in some silo in the Soviet Union, 5,000 miles, an hour and a half away from us? The nuclear freeze movement by itself will not remove from the reality that the world's peace is being held in place by mutual assured deterrence at all. It'll simply say the escalation and the rate of escalation of the threat will at least be held in place for a while. I think that many are undertaking this freeze movement in the hope that it will somehow do more than it can, in fact, on the surface accomplish. And they are doing so regardless of the risk that's involved. Because we must recognize that the Reagan administration is correct, at least in this, But the two societies are not of the same kind. A nuclear freeze movement, an anti-nuclear movement in the United States can in fact paralyze the ability of the government to put money into new weapons, to put money into the hardening of weapons that already exist. Our Congress can refuse to vote the money which the administration says it requires. The Congress under President Carter did in fact refuse to vote the money which he requested for the B-2 bomber and for the MX missile. And the Soviet Union might be moved to believe that it will accomplish all its ends by simply encouraging the freeze movement and other such movements here, all the while going merrily ahead with its own military development, until the point that is reached when we are under such a nuclear threat that survival at any cost becomes the only possible end. Now, there have been those who have come to the conclusion, as Mr. Schell has, or seems to, that the only issue which faces the world today is the issue of survival. And it follows from that, if one argues out the logic, it follows from that that then we must simply disarm and trust to the ultimate change of history, that somehow we will survive and ultimately the societies, the beliefs, the values which we cherish will reemerge despite the fact that we would become subservient to, if not dominated by, the Soviet Union. Now, unilateral disarmament has its own appeal to those who believe in certain kinds of messianic action. The problem is that most of the unilateralist disarmament scenarios assume that there's only one enemy, one other member of the nuclear club. But in point of fact, we've not been able to staunch the proliferation of nuclear arms any more than we've been able to staunch the escalation of nuclear armaments in the Soviet Union and the United States. And so Communist China has a nuclear weapons system. The Arab world will soon have a nuclear weapons system. France has a nuclear weapons system. India has some nuclear weapons. And under unilateral disarmament, it's as likely that we would become simply subordinate to citizens of, for what it's worth, the Soviet Union, as it's likely to other that all the members of nuclear club outside the United States would begin like dogs to fight over the carrion, and that our very weakness might encourage the very nuclear holocaust which we would be disarming to avoid. In testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about a year ago, Cardinal Kroll of the Philadelphia Diocese argued that nuclear weaponry is evil, that even the thought of developing a nuclear arsenal is a sin, because the thought is tantamount to the deed. And when he was faced with the question of what then, he said, elliptically at least, that history is a record of change, and that societies grow, and the assumption is that though we might be dominated by some other group, ultimately that which is native and indigenous to our society would reemerge. I'm not so sure that that's a scenario that would be followed. There's no evidence in our world that any government under an effective totalitarian regime, any people under an effective totalitarian regime ever regain or gain any measure of independence. Is then survival itself the only hope that we have? And if so, must we at this point simply plunge ahead rather hysterically, claiming that deterrence is an evil, deterrence won't work, and that therefore what we ought to do is to disarm all weapons of all kinds, all use of power of all types, of all kinds is evil, and is therefore to be avoided? I think not. There's no guarantee that deterrence will work. But there's no evidence that something less than deterrence will work either. We need, as I have said, to become political activists in the sense that we demand of those we elect to office that they use their efforts effectively and with some sense of urgency to force the administration to engage in constant, round-the-clock, round-the-year, round-the-decade negotiations with all other powers which are involved in the so-called nuclear club. We need to have SALT treaties, and we need to have strategic arms reduction treaties. We need to have nuclear-free zones. We need to have any arrangement at all which reduces the chance of a nuclear holocaust. But how to achieve this is something which eludes our conception. And so I have what is essentially a mad proposal to present to you. I think we've been going at this process the wrong way. In Wonderland, the world which we live in Wonderland, you don't try and increase defense. You try and increase the capacity of all countries to destroy your own society and for you to destroy theirs. Paradoxically, it is the anti-ballistic missile, it is the various defense systems of the various countries which threaten peace in the sense that mutual assured deterrence is effective. And so my proposal is what I call scrap. My proposal is that we should scrap and get the Soviet Union to scrap all of the bomb shelters, all of those reinforced concrete piles which have been in place more in the Soviet Union and China than the United States, into which populations presumably can be crowded in order to survive a nuclear war. And most especially, I would negotiate or have our government negotiate with the Soviet Union a proposal to blow up all of those concrete bomb shelters designed for the leadership of both countries. For in point of fact, if mutual assured deterrence is to work, Mr. Brezhnev must be killed and Mr. Reagan must be killed as well as you and I, because it's ultimately they who control whether or not the missiles are sent from the silos or from the submarines or from the bombers. And it is altogether possible, given the human being as we are, for an elected leader or for a self-appointed leader to say, we will ultimately survive the infrastructure, the party, the few, my disciples will survive. Because before I push the button, we're going to be in the bomb shelter. I and my wife and my family and my party and my friends. And yes, it'll be too bad that 2.5 million people in Cleveland, Ohio will be killed. And 5.5 maybe people in Stalingrad will be killed. But the society will survive, we will win. It's only if the leaders are as exposed as the followers that there's any chance for mutual assured deterrence to work. So my mad proposal, scrap. There is no worse proposal before the American people than this administration's $4.5 billion proposal to increase the civil defense of the United States. That's moving in the very reverse direction of what needs to be done. We need, but more importantly, our leaders need to feel exposed. Anybody who is exposed to the danger of pushing a button which will destroy his family and his friends will think twice. He may be prepared to destroy 20 cities in some other country and have 25 million people of his own destroyed because, after all, we're an overpopulated world and at least we'll have destroyed the enemy. But he'll think twice and twice again, I think, before he will press the button if he or she is exposed as we are. And so if I were involved in organizing the nuclear protests which are around the country, I wouldn't be carrying a banner which says ban the bomb. My banner would be ban the bomb shelter. And my banner would not say nuclear disarmament. My banner would say keep the White House exposed. And I would not be as concerned about the kinds of romantic, messianic programs which will never come to be, which the Shells and the others are putting before us. I'm reminded as an historian of another period of danger, when the Black Plague swept over Europe, 12th, 13th century. The bubonic plague seemed to come out of nowhere to strike down half to three quarters of a city. And as people saw the spread of the Black Plague, it began in China and moved westward at a steady pace. They feared its onset, and all kinds of hysteric reactions were developed, and we became followers of the Pied Piper. The myth of the Pied Piper developed in those years. The little children being led out, people from Cleveland on even days moving out to Medina, which they have their alphabet, their names, last names begin with half of the first letters of the alphabet, and on the odd number of days moving out to Youngstown, if our names begin with the second half of the alphabet. Those kind of crazy plans, civil defense plans. Pied Pipers will lead us if we become frenzied. Pied Pipers will lead us into suicidal actions if we become so paralyzed by the fear of deterrence that we don't take the hard, necessary steps to create political accountability for atomic escalation. If we don't see to it that we elect and keep in office those who will negotiate, who will realistically confront the political needs, which alone can bring some measure of adjustment, stability into our world. Thomas Merton long ago wrote a book called 'Tis a Mad World, My Masters. And it is a mad world that we live in. But in this world of madness, what seems to be sanity is often the worst madness, the paradox. In this world, which is so mad, mad for arms, mad for whatever, I don't know, we've got to accept the fact that we in our homes need a police force, that deterrence is the police force of the world, that as far as we know, deterrence is the only effective mechanism at our disposal to hold aggressors in line, hold our own aggression in line, and therefore that the means towards peace are not to go directly against this concept of deterrence and to claim it to be the folly that it really is, because it can work. But it's rather to create the political conditions which will force the leaders of the world to work out plans which will reduce the danger of atomic war. Not simply miscalculation, but will reduce little by little the levels of armament, the degree of overkill, until perhaps in some other generation the world can emerge from under the cloud of deterrence and begin to act as if we were truly sane. Amen.